What does it mean to be free? What has the war economy done to the lives of Americans? Join others for all the solutions at thespiritualun.org, because another world is possible. No human being is an enemy of another human being. War is a manufactured and artificial state. There is another way to live in this world through a new system that is uplifting to all. Let's go to a higher love. What did Jesus really teach? Did he teach onward Christian soldiers and bomb one another? No. John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Abraham Lincoln, our founding fathers, and you, your neighbors, all reaching for the best part of the human spirit. TheSpiritualUN.org, come together with us, carrying forward this nation's founders' universal ideals through the rejection of revenge, aggression, racism, war, and the debt slavery system. Real men don't kill. War and the debt slavery system is a crime against us all, against God, against all life, and is not fit for a progressive world. Join together here at thespiritualun.org, and we will build that new world for the 99% of us, without any leaders, corrupt as they are, because in the new system that is uplifting to all, they aren't necessary anymore. thespiritualun.org.
It's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
Welcome to another edition of the New American Dream Radio Show. We're glad you decided to listen to us tonight. I've just been enjoying some turkey soup. I think it's my favorite part of the turkey for Thanksgiving is the soup that I make with the leftovers. This year it came out especially good. Even my wife had 3 or 4 cups of the soup, and she doesn't like soup. So it must have been pretty good. I certainly thought it was. You know, Thanksgiving, well, of course, it's all about giving thanks. And we do have a lot to be thankful for. In spite of all the things that we complain about, there's a lot of good things in America and in the world. And it's good that we can protest still, even though we're rapidly becoming more of a police state. We're still relatively free compared to a lot of the rest of the world. And we're very unfree compared to a lot of the rest of the world. I think maybe there's still hope. The Occupy movement gives me hope. Protests in general make me feel good about people. Feel like people are actually trying to get out and do something, and sometimes it actually works. I think about the music that's associated with protests. Keep in mind, I'm a child of the 60s, you know. I was in my teens in the 60s and went down to Maritime, Washington a few times in late 60s, early 70s. We marched against the war in Vietnam. We marched against the draft. We marched for civil rights, for the right to vote for younger people. One of the things that I remember the best was the phenomenal music there. All sorts of people. Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Richie Havens. Looks like I got into this music thing because I was thinking about the traditional Thanksgiving protest song, "You can get anything you want at Alice's restaurant." Good old Arlo Guthrie and his extended rendition. talking about getting arrested, wine justice, and the draft. I listen to the song every year around this time. Did that a few weeks back. It was fun. I don't know if any of you are Grateful Dead fans like I am, but there was a great giveaway at dead.net. They gave away a song every day last month. You can still download them, I think. You might want to check that out if you like to use it. Anyway, we have a dream here at the radio show that we really want to make a difference in America and in the world. Things we'd like to do, well, we'd like everybody to be able to eat. We'd like everybody to be able to have a roof over their head. We'd like to end the war. We'd like to have the people in office quit lying to us. I know this is the stuff of dreams, but without dreams, hard to come up with the goals to actually make any changes. So there's nothing, it's not so bad to dream. That's our dream. A better place. Dreams started back in, dreams have been around a long, forever, but one type of dream in America was back in the Kennedy years, and then he got shot, and other people got shot, Martin, Bobby. It was a time of assassination, and John Lennon got shot not too long after. But dreams are good, and we hope you like ours. Now I'd like to turn it over to my friend and co-host, Mike Palachuk, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome old friends Alice Charbonnier of the Baltimore Chronicle and Sherwood Ross, our regular radio columnist of the air, speaking to us tonight from Coral Gables, Florida. It's again time for the New American Dream Radio Show, the American Russian novel, All We Need Is More Vodka Radio Hour. Because we have the winds of our own totalitarian society freezing the land solid, a tortured tundra. Some of those who have spoken the truth are no longer here. You might notice that their chairs at the Thanksgiving adult big table are empty. Their relatives have sent them to Siberia merely with a roll of their eyes. So let us begin. Here we go. Scooch up to the samovar. Maybe leave your hat and boots on. Fill your peasant hands with a warm drink and listen always for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice. The following was presented by John Kennedy quite a long time ago. He said, "We are not afraid to entrust the American people with unpleasant facts, foreign ideas, alien philosophies, and competitive values. For a nation that is afraid to let its people judge the truth and falsehood in an open market is a nation that is afraid of its people." And can you imagine hearing anything like that today? You know, back then we just thought that we were fighting these things, fighting for these things. We would just keep getting better and better and better, and the sky was the limit. And we did not realize that we were going to come right up against it, and that that was a sudden end, I believe, that day, November 22nd, 1963, to our hopes and dreams. And we have just become more and more conservative. I think that the 60s, the rich people got together in a room or somewhere, you know what I mean, in a room. They got together somehow, and they planned that they weren't going to take it anymore. And then we got the Reagan Revolution, and we got such wimpy Democrats as Gore and Clinton and Obama. And so I think it's all come downhill from that day when we thought we were just going to solve it all. We were going to solve poverty. We're going to solve war. We're going to almost like saying, what else you got? We can handle it all. But that's what it's all about, folks. That's what we are asking for at the New American Dream, the opportunity for a free and open airing of ideas. And it may seem on the surface that we have that now, but if you think that the current setup of the major media in the United States, from National Public Radio to the so-called nightly news on TV, is a free and open airing of ideas, we think that you are mistaken. We believe it is actually to be compared to the Soviet Union of the 1960s. It's the American version, that is, of totalitarianism, where there can be no honest discussion of who actually did 9/11, or who actually killed John F. Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin King, and others, and that matters. It matters a great deal. For the successful clamping down by the corporate big media, big-time media on dissenting ideas has led to endless war and endless profits for a few people, and that is what the Occupy movement is all about. We believe that what is needed is the truth about our history, and that's important, which might also lead to prison sentences for those responsible for many atrocities committed in the name of American freedom, and we also say, so be it. For a nation that is afraid to let its people judge the truth and falsehood in an open market is a nation that is afraid of its people. We cannot be afraid.
WorldNewsTrust.com is a news site that is trying to define the new mainstream. Their founder, Francis Goodwin, is a veteran journalist who set out on his own a few years ago and has slowly carved out a niche. What does the site do? It tells the truth and provides a place for intelligent columnists to talk about what's really happening in America. It's a good site with people who care about what's going on in America and the world. It's a great site with many loyal writers, including Ramsey Baroud, Harvey Wasserman, Mickey Z. There are too many to list them all. Some content is published on World News Trust first, some is published elsewhere and copied to World News Trust. We also welcome back World News Trust, who continue to support our show and host our website. Visit World News Trust for a dose of news with enlightened and informed opinion. It's not like Fox or CNN or the New York Times. It's World News Trust, defining the new mainstream in online journalism. Visit them today and tell them the New American Dream Radio Show sent you. WorldNewsTrust.com.
We wish to give a shout-out to those listening in on the Armed Forces Network, ships at sea, military bases in 9,000 countries around the world, the U.S. Special Forces snipers in the Khyber Pass in Afghanistan, the Oakland Police Department, the correctional officers in Terre Haute, the federal penitentiary there, the Immigrant Detention Center in Phoenix, COINTELPRO spies in the Minneapolis Occupy movement, the BOP snitches in the Chicago Metropolitan Correctional Center, and the Homeland Security undercover lunch ladies in the kitchen of Regis Jesuit High School in Denver. Thank you for the work you do in keeping us all safe and able to worship at any church we want to, sitting wherever we want in that particular church or synagogue or TP, having the freedom that not everyone has around the world, taking whatever street we want to take, any route whatsoever to get to that place of worship. When we get to that place of God or Yahweh or Buddha or Bubba or Alan the Alien or the Almighty Sun God, that we and, well, not everyone in the world has the freedom to do this, park wherever we want in that parking lot. We choose our own selves as Americans, and we walk up that building or teepee or grass hut or adobe temple something, and we walk in single file or as a group to that particular church or place of worship as free Americans. Thank you for all you do in tuning in and killing who needs to be killed, locking up however many people need to be locked up so the rest of us can be free. Free as Americans. Not everyone has the freedom to do that. Go to church, then go home and pig out, watch a football game, take a nap, get up, eat some more. Oh, thank you for your service. You're our heroes, our protectors. Amen.
I'd now like to welcome our first guest, Alice Charbonnier. Alice Charbonnier lives in Baltimore. She was born in Talbot County on Maryland's Eastern Shore. She graduated from the University of Maryland School of Law in 1975. Since 1976, she has been a writer and editor for the Baltimore Chronicle, an independent newspaper founded in 1973. Hello, Alice. How are you?
Hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, you live in Baltimore and you've working in a newspaper, and I was just wondering if you ever met Phil Berrigan. He also lived in Baltimore for a long time.
Oh yeah, plenty of times. Yeah, wonderful man.
Yeah, I met him once in Washington, and I think once in Minnesota, but I was really impressed. Did you have a chance to go over to Jonah House to meet with him, or how did your paths cross?
Well, I've always been interested in peace and justice issues. I'm a Quaker, and we used to have dinners, potluck dinners, where we would feature people who were leaders in that area, and he oftentimes was the chief guest. And his daughter, his two daughters actually, his older daughter and my son both were occupied with peace and justice issues while they were teenagers, so we would cross paths a lot of times in those ways too. He really had a very long and distinguished career as an activist, and he really walked the walk, talked the talk.
Yeah, he sure did. Could you tell me what you're covering in the Baltimore Chronicle these days? What's a big stories?
Well, we continue to cover health care inequities and issues regarding what other countries are doing about health care for their people versus what we're doing and how we might be able to fix things. We try to bring in information from other sources outside the U.S. to supplement what's available elsewhere. And we also are making our paper, which is just online now. We stopped the actual print edition when my husband died a few years ago. And we find my brother and I and about three other people scour the media to find what we think are the very best stories. And then we post them, and people can go from our site to the originating site. And then we have annotations and our own stories. So there's that, the economic situation, and probably we're more fiscally conservative than maybe a lot of other progressive sites because we've been in business so long ourselves. But one of the things that we're covering is other ways to interpret the Occupy Wall Street movement, for example. It's kind of a limiting and polarizing kind of an approach, I think. And so I was, maybe if it's possible, to add a few points into the discussion about observations that we're making that might be useful to people, I'd be glad to do it.
Yes, go. One of them is go ahead, whatever you want.
Hello?
Yes,
can you hear me?
What?
Oh, okay. Yeah, there was a really good story in the New York Times Magazine this past Sunday about the dwindling power of a college degree, but it really was kind of a retrospective of what's been happening in our society since 1973. That's when they're kind of positioning the change from the old way that, you know, you could expect to get a job and have a career and work your way up the ladder and have benefits and a pension and, you know, the American dream kind of a thing. And it began to unravel about then and has proceeded since, and it's getting faster and faster. And this is something that, you know, banks, whatever the banks may or may not do, they can't repair some of the really difficult situations that we're finding for our young people, because there just are so few jobs that have meaning, and it's going to not get better except if people get a real ability to think fast, have a really good education, speak other languages probably because you have to be international now. Otherwise, there's going to be a lot of dead-end assignments, good years and bad years, uncertainty. It's going to be a big flux for an awful lot of people. And, you know, yeah, I think that young people should be protesting it, but I think that we ought to maybe not just be focusing on some people having more, but rather what can be done to help equalize the situation so that people can have some kind of a meaningful life. You know, there's got to be jobs we can help create. The government, I think, would have to help. But right now, I don't see that we can do it because we're so far in debt and we still have all this defense spending and, you know, nothing's looking good. It's really a tragic situation. And I did a little research about how things used to be in the Victorian era for the banks in Britain and also, you know, among the industrialists in the U.S. And not all of the people were rapacious, greedy people. Like Andrew Carnegie, I found a quote by him. He said, "The man who dies rich dies disgraced." Now, who would be saying that today? Maybe Bill Gates' father-in-law. I don't know. But it's an attitude that some corporate titans have had that we really don't see that much. And maybe we need to think about what's changed in corporate culture and how can that perhaps be rolled back. And I know it's going to take a long time, and everybody wants things to change fast, but I don't see how we can get fast change when it's a cultural kind of a thing. But it can be done. That's the thing. If we have the will to do it, it's kind of cyclical almost. How big business, you know, operates as a corporate citizen or doesn't. So, anyway, hope that wasn't too long.
There's a quote somewhere that I don't know the exact words, but it says a change in a people's thinking is the real revolution. Maybe it was before the American Revolution. A change in a people's thinking is a real revolution, and it precedes the action that takes place. And maybe what you're talking about is the pre-revolutionary change of attitude that needs to takes place in the education. I don't know.
Right. Yeah, and we have to be thinking about what do we all need from each other, and maybe we could create jobs out of that. Like, if we have more leisure time, then what do we want to learn? And, you know, each person could perhaps, people who have talent could be tutors. We pay the tutors, then they learn something new. And it would be kind of small, but it would create an energy, and it would be something that could be done here in this country as opposed to overseas. I mean, it's really getting, I had to have some repair done on a Xerox printer a couple of weeks ago, and I had an assistant by phone to help me walk through it, and his accent was really good, but I couldn't figure out whether he was from the southern states or whether he was from Canada. You know, he had accents from both places, and turned out that he was in Thailand. He had learned English so well that you really couldn't tell, and this is how it's going, you know, and outsourcing is a smart way to do business, and so we need to think of how we can do insourcing, and that's the trick. And I think one of my favorite things to do with people, like, and it really quiets things down at a party, you know, you ask people, okay, we need jobs, what job would you create if you could create it? And people look like deer in the headlights, you know, people haven't really thought that way, but we need perhaps a whole lot more of us to be thinking in an entrepreneurial way. Because the solution, obviously, is not going to be coming from the top, because they're chopping off, you know, jobs just right and left. It's going to have to come from the grassroots people. And instead of sitting around maybe thinking about what's wrong and what other people aren't doing, just say, hey, you know, we can figure out something to do and then do it. And it sounds kind of naive, but there have been a lot of enterprises that have started on bootstraps like that and helping each other. So
I'm sorry.
I mean, I was getting my teeth cleaned today, and the hygienist said, it's a pretty big practice, one of those managed practice places, and she said, you know, there's only two of us who are here today that were working here last year at this time. That in 1 year's time, they had got rid of every experienced person except for the two that remained, and she was worried about her job, all because they can hire new people cheaper. You know, it's not just outsourcing outside the U.S., it's outsourcing by getting younger people that are just out of school at a lower price. I mean, it's kind of shocking and scary to see how this is happening to people. So,
did you ever think about running for office? That's probably crossed your mind a few times.
Yeah, a lot of people suggest I do that. And it's, you know, if I had the money to do it, you know, because it costs so much money. And there's another story. Did you hear about how apparently Congress is taking up, the Republicans in Congress are saying, let's change the law about public, you know, paying for elections, you know, the public finance. They want to get rid of it to save money, whereas the Democrats want to try to revive it and perhaps retool it, but not get rid of it, to make it better. But the idea that there would be not any public financing available, that there are those in Congress who want to get rid of it altogether, it's kind of scary. It means that people who run for office have to be people that are beholden to other people who give them money, or else they have to be independently wealthy and willing to give it up. It's not exactly what you would call a democratic situation. There's, you know, a few instances where you could get in on the ground floor, maybe on the city council or county council, and make a name for yourself, and then step into a state delegate job and work your way up to a state senator job and then maybe move to Congress, you know. That would take you maybe 20 years, and it still would have plenty of money involved, but it's not what I can do. So, you know, newspapers have been a good way to try to put things out there for people to think about. And actually, I came across a really interesting little factoid about journalists, about print journalists, that a lot of a lot of us in print, you know, we're bemoaning how many jobs have been lost in journalism. And there really have been. I mean, you should see the Baltimore Sun here. It's a shadow of its former self. There's hardly any news in it. And most all of what is there is from the Tribune corporations, not even locally produced. It's pitiful. But one of the reasons that there are fewer writers employed by newspapers is because of Craigslist, because they've lost this really, you know, big cash cow that newspapers used to pretty much control, the classified ads. Now they don't have them. And having lost that, that was a much bigger part of their revenue than people realized. And apparently that alone can account for a lot of the layoffs.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine, going back to the Occupy movement, you've been covering it, or you know pretty much what's going on there. What is happening in Baltimore with the Occupy movement in, like, the last few days or last week or so?
Well, we still have some people down near City Hall, and you know, we're collecting warm clothing for them, that kind of thing. And there hasn't been, like in other cities, there hasn't been a raid or a dispersion yet. I think it's fair to say that a lot of people of all stripes admire that young people especially are standing for something. They're not quite sure what, but that they are concerned, that they're showing that they're not brain dead, that they know something's wrong and they want something fixed. And there's so much that needs to be done. I guess, you know, people are saying, well, there's no real leader and there's no real agenda, and that might be the reason that the movement has taken off the way it has. But it also, because it's kind of scattered, maybe how it might not be as effective as it could be if it could be somehow brought together on particular points. And it's unfortunate that the focus is on this 1% business, because in fact, you know, that makes a nice phrase and it's catchy and all that, but it's really not 1%, it's 1/10 of 1%. That's the 1/10 of 1% who have so much more than the others. And the 1%, you know, they're very well off, but they're not anywhere near like a titan, like the ones that are in that rarefied atmosphere. I mean, it's really frightening how fast we've had this concentration of wealth. It's gone to just a very few people. I mean, all you need is about 10 sets of Koch brothers and the country's doomed, you know? And that kind of thing can happen now. Because once you have that wealth and you have good accountants and you know, good tax advisors and all that kind of thing, you can put that money all over the world and shelter it, and you know, you can buy up nonprofits to influence opinion. It's already happened. How we can counter it now that it's happened, I don't know.
Well, Alice, thank you for your work, over the years that you've done, and thank you for your time tonight. And I hope you'll be able to come back and visit with us in a couple months. And in closing, could you maybe tell people how they can find the Baltimore Chronicle on the web?
Sure. It's baltimorechronicle.com. And if people go there and they want to sign up for our breaking news list, we also do an email news list of stories that we find all over the place that are just, you know, just as they come out. So, and then we hope that people who are on the Baltimore News Network, that they'll circulate stories as well so that we can have a megaphone effect.
Well, thank you very much, Allison. Have a good night.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Yep, bye.
What does it mean to be free? What has the war economy done to the lives of Americans? Join others for all the solutions at thespiritualun.org, because another world is possible. No human being is an enemy of another human being. War is a manufactured and artificial state. There is another way to live in this world through a new system that is uplifting to all. Let's go to a higher love. What did Jesus really teach? Did he teach onward Christian soldiers and bomb one another? No. John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Abraham Lincoln, our founding fathers, and you, your neighbors, all reaching for the best part of the human spirit. TheSpiritualUN.org. Come together with us, carrying forward this nation's founders' universal ideals through the rejection of revenge, aggression, racism, war, and the debt slavery system. Real men don't kill. War and the debt slavery system is a crime against us all, against God, against all life, and is not fit for a progressive world. Join together here at thespiritualun.org, and we will build that new world for the 99% of us, without any leaders, corrupt as they are, because in the new system that is uplifting to all, they aren't necessary anymore. thespiritualun.org.
And now we bring you the New American Dream Masterpiece Classic Playhouse Theater something. Real voices with a message you will not hear on the CBS Nightly News. Mike Prisoner, Iraq war veteran. The real enemies are not in some distant land. They're not people whose names we don't know and cultures we don't understand. The enemy is people we know very well and can identify. The enemy is a system that wages war when it is profitable. The enemy is the CEOs who lay us off from our jobs when it is profitable. The insurance companies who deny us health care when it is profitable. It's the banks who take away our homes when it is profitable. Our enemy is not 5,000 miles away. They're right here, at home. If we organize with our sisters and brothers, we can stop this war, we can stop this government, we can create a better world. Now we hear the voice of Philip F. Nelson, author of LBJ, The Mastermind of JFK's Assassination. The man should be known for what he was, a world-class criminal. A thorough cleansing of the national conscience is in order after all these years to enable Americans to reconcile the personal tragedy suffered by John F. Kennedy and the national tragedy suffered by the country at large at the hands of Lyndon B. Johnson. Until the real story of the 36th president is exposed and the complete truth of his crimes against the United States and the world are acknowledged, there will always be questions lurking about the trustworthiness of the government itself. And finally, a rare hearing of the voice of William Pepper, attorney for Sirhan Sirhan, now attempting to be released from prison for the 1968 murder of Robert Kennedy on the grounds that Sirhan was programmed to be a patsy and a decoy for the real killer, shooting from behind Kennedy in the Ambassador Hotel pantry that hot summer night. The American people have been called by numbers of people all over the world as being the most dumbed-down population in the Western civilization. Certainly, they're probably among the least politically and other ways sophisticated people in Western culture. It's no accident. It's no testimony to the lack of intelligence and potential of the citizens of this republic. It's a testimony to the control of thinking and the flow of information that people are allowed to have, the effects of the media, and thought control that has been developed in this country. It's extraordinary and it's very difficult to overcome. One wonders how long it's going to take for the uprising to occur. And I actually think we may be reaching a point where we're entering a pre-revolutionary stage. And now, we'd like to welcome Sherwood Ross, a regular radio columnist for the New American Dream. Sherwood is a veteran journalist who now directs the Anti-War News Service. His reporting and commentaries on political and military topics appear on hundreds of internet sites globally. And people look for the shows that feature Sherwood Ross. So it's a treat to have him back. Welcome to the show, Sherwood.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the opportunity, and thanks to all of your listeners for making this possible and for supporting New American Dream Radio. I was thinking the other day, we Americans are taught in high school civics that the French Revolution marked a bloody period in France's history. And sure, we're sympathetic with any public that wants to oust a king and set up a democracy. But our civics teachers told us the French Revolution was not the way to go about this. And why not? Well, seems the French radicals had no regard for human life. They tried the royalists who supported King Louis XIV and beheaded them. And it wasn't much of a trial either for any of them, at least not by modern standards of justice. In 1 year during what we now call the French Reign of Terror, about 1,000 people were tried and sent to the guillotine. The engineer of that bloodbath was a man named Maximilian Robespierre, who eventually got his own head chopped off by his enemies as well. I bring up all this old stuff, going back to 1789, because President Obama today is waging an illegal war as bloody and as brutal as the French Revolution, and nobody says anything about it. For all anybody knows, Mr. Obama may be killing as many people in the Middle East today as Robespierre killed in France. I know this is not a nice thing to say about the gentleman from Chicago, but let's examine the evidence. We find more than a few similarities between Robespierre and Obama. First, they were officials having absolute life and death power over their victims. President Obama, like a king, thinks he can order the death of any suspect anywhere in the world. And a suspect, mind you, is just that. It's a man who hasn't been convicted of anything in court. Second, like Robespierre, Mr. Obama believes he's doing the right thing. He's proud of it. Third, like Robespierre, Obama has his Congress solidly behind him. The basic difference is that Robespierre killed with the guillotine, and Obama kills with airborne robots. One way the French Revolution was more merciful than President Obama's killing is that the French dragged only the accused individual to the guillotine. When the CIA or the Pentagon shoots off a Hellfire missile, it could be a bad day for the whole neighborhood. I'll come back to this in a minute. Forecasting the future of robotic warfare, in which perverted science is put at the service of its empire, the USA has built 60 bases around the world for its killer drone warplanes that shoot these Hellfire missiles, and more are being built. You can see what the trend is. Investigative journalist Nick Terse, he writes for Alternet and Tom Dispatch, says, and I quote, "Run by the military and the Central Intelligence Agency, these bases are the backbone of a new robotic way of war," end quote. Reporter Terse says there may be even more than 60 bases, as the Pentagon has dropped a cloak of secrecy over them. With the recent murder of American citizen Anwar al-Awlaki in Yemen, Terse says the drones are now assassinating suspects in no fewer than 6 countries. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting Obama's Pentagon is building a constellation of secret drone bases in the Horn of Africa and the Arabian Peninsula to get at Al-Qaeda in Somalia and Yemen. Some drone airstrips are located right here in the U.S., centered at Creech Air Force Base outside Las Vegas. At Creech, these so-called pilots, who never get in the real plane, sit in front of computer screens. They can direct unmanned drones to launch a Hellfire missile on a suspect in Afghanistan, 7,500 miles away. And at Fort Benning, Georgia, a new advanced drone is being tested. The Washington Post says it's the next step to a future in which drones will, and I quote, hunt, identify, and kill the enemy based on calculations made by software, not decisions made by humans, end quote. In the first 10 months of his rule, President Obama vastly increased drone strikes in the Middle East, assigning the CIA a big role in Pakistan. It should be remembered, by the way, the president is a former CIA employee. The New Yorker magazine reported October 25th, 2009, that since taking office, President Obama, it's the first 10 months, sanctioned 41 CIA drone hits in Pakistan that killed between 326 and 538 people, many of them innocent bystanders, including children. In fact, the first two strikes took place on January 23rd, President Obama's third day in office, and one hit the wrong house of a pro-government tribal leader, killed his entire family, including three children, one just 5 years old. The New Yorker noted that when another suspect was attacked while sunning himself on his roof, the missile also demolished the house under him, wiping out his entire family. And the killing of 25 Pakistani soldiers just the other day by NATO plane only reinforces the view that intelligence agencies don't always know who the enemy is, any more than they knew whether Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. The drone planes, aptly named Predator and Reaper, have become so popular in the Pentagon, defense contractors can't keep up with the demand for them. In fact, the Pentagon plans to buy 700 new drone systems in the next decade. And get this, the New Yorker says the Pentagon plans, quote, new generations of tiny nano drones, which can fly after their prey like a killer bee through an open window, end quote. Suspects targeted for extinction by drones are fingered by the CIA and military intelligence. And who knows what legal standards, if any, are being used? Is a man a terrorist who takes up arms against troops who occupy his country? None of the suspects ever get to retain a lawyer. None see a judge. None get a chance to plead to a jury. In short, President Obama's foes are being assassinated with zero pretense of a legal proceeding. Webster's dictionary defines assassination as to kill suddenly or secretively, especially to murder a politically prominent person, or to destroy or harm treacherously and viciously. Hey, this description perfectly fits what the Pentagon and CIA are doing. Now, all of this, let's put it in perspective, it's just one more aspect of the American empire's mass dragnet arrests of innocent individuals who are never brought to trial. At Guantanamo, 800 prisoners arrested over a 10-year period, and only 7 brought to trial. 7. That's not a judicial system. It's a non-judicial system. And the drone warfare campaign is also non-judicial. And what do you call countries that operate this way without justice? How about tyrannies, sad to say? At least in the French Reign of Terror, the accused came before a sort of a mob called the Paris Revolutionary Tribunal. That's more than can be said for the drone strike victims. In Paris, the accused cannot hire a defense lawyer, call witnesses, and the only sentence that could be passed was death, and it's the same way that's being applied in today's drone attacks, with the approval of President Obama, who has turned back the clock on international jurisprudence by 200 years to before the time of the French Reign of Terror in 1789. Why shouldn't we call him the American Robespierre? Let's think about that. If you can, have a good night to every one of you.
Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red China, Johnny Ray, South Pacific, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio, Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon, Studebaker Television, North Korea, South Korea, Marilyn Monroe, Fallujah, Waco, OKC, Paul Wellstone, Bobby Kennedy. We started the fire, the world was just turning, but it wasn't burning. We didn't like it, we just had to light it. Burn it down, shock and awe, fire in the hole. Hold on to your hats, boys. Guatemala, Chile, Vietnam, Desert Storm, Guantanamo. Malcolm MLK, Florida, Ohio, vote stolen by Bush. 9/11, inside job, Northwoods, Nicaragua, Panama, and El Salvador. Attica, Terre Haute, Leavenworth, Lewisburg, Marion, Rikers Island, Lompoc, Folsom, Angelo, San Quentin, Florence, Colorado. Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Harry Truman, Paul Tibbetts. Gene Kirkpatrick, Gerald Ford, Dick Cheney, Karl Rove, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Rush Limbaugh. Drones murder in Pakistan, shock and awe in Baghdad, Afghan, Iran, fighter jet Super Bowl, grassy knoll. Obama, no change, he's in the CIA, JFK, blown away, what else do I have to say?
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Joe Coffey, Coffee Joe, the Democratic candidate, has volunteered to go inside the compound where the farmer rebels have taken over the Factory Hog Confinement Corporation. Joe is supposed to be in there trying to find a way to end this peacefully. Right now he's out in the grove with Eddie Zook, one of the rebel young guns. Joe is seated on the ground, his back to a tree, and Eddie has a shotgun pointed at Joe, telling Joe that Joe's wife, Jane, is Eddie's old girlfriend, his first love. Eddie has also told Joe that way back when, in Omaha, it was Eddie who was hired by the law to kill Joe's protester friend, Charlie Calhoun, and he's also been hired again to infiltrate the farmer group, and he's going to kill Coffee Joe. Before he left to go take a tour with Eddie, Joe had shoved a piece of toilet paper into Sam Tinker's hand. On it he had written, Eddie, FBI, because Joe had just had a hunch, and he wanted to live, maybe even long enough to find out what life in Washington was like. Well, Joe saw that Eddie was sexually excited. Eddie rubbed himself as if he had to go to the bathroom. Joe judged the distance to leap in order to plunge his shoulder into Eddie Zook's waist.
Sam Tinker put a large left hand into the air and asked for a vote. Then sent his right hand into his sweatshirt pocket for gum and pulled out the wad of toilet paper Joe Coffey had stuck in his hand. He unraveled it, read it, grabbed his shotgun leaning against the podium, and dashed out of the room. Ray scrambled after him. Hey, we got a vote in progress here, Herb Pollard. He pulled himself up by the podium, told the men to pass their papers to the end of the row. And with those at the end, bring the sheets up here, please. Sam blasted out the headquarters door like an offensive tackle who had fallen asleep on the toilet before the Super Bowl. Where'd they go? Where'd they go? He asked the man sitting on the bench. Who? Coffee. Joe. Eddie. One gestured toward the woods. Sam sprinted across the yard, his knees pumping to his chest, his curly black hair flowing. Ray did his best to keep up, losing his cap but not stopping to retrieve it. They dashed between two confinements, jumped the barbed wire fence, and crashed into the grove. Sam! Ray yelled. What the hell are you doing? Boom. The roar of the shotgun blast sent Sam to his knees. Ray dived onto his stomach. He slid and slithered to greet Sam, who knelt in the mulch, his mouth open, his eyes wide, staring into the grove. Get down! Ray pushed Sam to the ground and began checking for blood. Over there, Sam pointed. That way. He pushed Ray away and scrambled to stand. The lookouts had begun jumping down from their perches and running in the direction of the gunshot. Sam struggled to pull himself up by a tree and trudged off after him.
Ray followed, holding his rifle at his chest, scanning behind them and on each side. They saw the men standing around the tree where Joe's torso sat. Sam pushed into the circle and stared. Joe's head was blown away. From the place where his chin curved slightly upward, he had no face. The back of his head rested against the tree, and the interior of his skull looked like a watermelon that had been dug into by someone's bare hands. His legs were crossed in a figure four. His palms rested flat. Eddie's camouflaged face was spotted red. He tried to make a break for it. Eddie still had the gun focused on Joe.
Well, it looks like he was just sitting, somebody said. Eddie picked that person out and challenged him. He was going to run. You want that? Run where? Said Sam. He was going to walk out the front door in a few hours. Why run? He pointed his gun at Eddie. Take his weapon. A farmer ripped away Eddie's shotgun. Sam motioned for Eddie to walk in front of him. One of the farmers picked up a chunk of Joe's skull, then another, like pieces of a doll's head. Jesus. Sam looked down at Joe. Can somebody do something about this? He searched the faces of the men. Eddie marched through the woods with the guns of Ray and Sam aimed at his back. He's FBI, Sam said to Ray, loud enough for Eddie to hear. Sam's phone rang. He picked it out of the holder of his belt. Well, you ought to know, Sam said to the agent by the road. We got nothing to say. No comment at this time. Sam turned the phone off, let it fall into the grass. One of the black helicopters appeared above the grove and dropped within 10 feet of the treetop. Eddie, Sam, and Ray knelt and turned their heads to the ground. A man in a black cap and vest aimed a weapon out the side door of the helicopter, sighting around the grove.
The helicopter pulled up and hurried to hover over the office building. A series of shots sent the helicopter higher. The pilot jerked the copter a safe distance from the farm. More shots came from the mailbox and office area. Sam heard a bullet whiz past his head. Get down! He waved his hand. Eddie and Ray hugged the ground. You take him to the chicken shed, Sam screamed into Ray's ear. Check on the men there. Go, now. Ray nodded and stuck the barrel of his rifle hard into Eddie's side. They took him off into the trees. They took off into the trees, crouching, sweating, both trying not to trip. Sam made his way to the edge of the grove, stood up and sprinted along the tree line toward the buildings. He smelled the evergreen needles that poked him. He leaped dead branches. Rotor blades whirred overhead. Sweat stung his eyes. He heard the FBI agent talking through a megaphone. He stumbled and hurtled forward, his chest slamming the ground.
Not noticing the burns on the inside of his arms, Sam picked up his weapon and charged toward the front line as a tear gas canister thudded and rolled in the dry, cracked feedlot dirt. Eddie pointed toward the east with startled eyes. Ray looked. Eddie kicked Ray in the nuts with his black boot, then in the chin, and stomped the heel of his boot into Ray's face as he lay on his back with his hands between his legs. Eddie ran, stumbling. He climbed from the cement pad of the manure lagoon to the chain-link fence. He steadied himself on the wire while stretching one leg on to the sloped roof. He pulled himself up, slicing his red hand on a ragged piece of sheet metal, then climbed and slipped and cursed his way to the top of the confinement. And then Eddie Zook stood and yanked the bandana from his head, waving it at the black helicopter. The copter banked over him, over toward him like a hawk on approach toward a gopher in the field. Eddie smiled and kept waving, motioning the copter pilot toward him like he was backing up a semi-truck to a loading dock. "That's it," Eddie cooed. "That's it." The copter turned on its axis, revealing a man kneeling in the door. The man had his black hat turned around backwards. "Dude!" Eddie waved his hand over his head. The man aimed an automatic rifle at Eddie.
A line of four National Guard tanks plowed through the front fence, headed toward the office building, cheered along by the sound of a pack of firecrackers exploding. The man in the copter door motioned with his hand to his pilot to pull away. Ray Tinker smelled gunpowder as he pointed his rifle where Eddie Zook was standing a second ago. On the other side of the slope confinement, Eddie Zook slid slowly on his back, down the roof, his arms, legs, and body in the shape of a swastika. As the bullets of the men guarding the lead confinement tinked off the tank armor, Eddie slipped from the roof over the fence of the manure lagoon.
The men in the confinement abandoned their positions, and Eddie plopped headfirst into the full lagoon. He sank slowly, like a metal spoon in a thick chocolate malt. His legs and feet were sticking straight up when Ray, wiping blood from under his nose, ran around to look through the wire fence. Ray Grimiston was hit in the chest by a .50 caliber round from the mounted machine gun on the lead tank. The whump threw Ray 10 yards onto his back. The tank commander, rolling past the lagoon, did not notice the two black boots sticking out of the brown sludge. Sam and Herb lay together on the floor of Sam's temporary office. Herb slumped against the outer wall, his mouth open, his eyes shut, his bloody fingernails dug into his chest. Sam poked his shotgun out the window at a tank headed straight for him.
Jane Coffey lay on the floor of an unmarked FBI vehicle, her mouth duct tape closed, her nose bent against her cheek, a teardrop-sized blood drop sitting on the edge of a nostril, her hands cuffed behind her back. The blonde FBI special agent drove carefully down the gravel road, stopping, avoiding collision with a flurry of men and vehicles involved in the assault. She turned right at the highway, throwing up gravel smoke from the shoulder as a state patrolman flagged the approaching media vehicles. Sheriff Smith and the older, thin, tall FBI agent, now wearing combat fatigues, carried M-16s up the drive, crouching low, following the tanks and the line of National Guardsmen from the 41st Mount Liberty Unit. Karen Tinker heard the pop-pop-pop noises as she scrubbed dishes without the radio on. She aimed an ear at the children's schoolroom, realized they were not there, then took a dish towel with her outside.
Karen Tinker stood on the cement slab porch, drying her hands, wondering about all that surge of ebony smoke pouring into the sky out by the corporate hog farm site, spreading across the county like a wall cloud of burning tires. A pair of 20-year-old National Guardsmen stood by the flagpole next to the flattened office building. Their shaved heads were bare and soaked with sweat. Their heavy knit shirts hanging out. They hoisted the United States flag while wiping their boots on the dirty clump, which was the wounded pig tablecloth rebel farmer standard. The smoke from the farm was joined by a unit of gray clouds. The daytime became dark as early evening. At the intersection of the highway and the gravel road leading to the mailbox at Conopasset Family Farm, Governor Smooth, wearing a gray suit, white shirt, and red tie, brushed his hair back and stepped from a rental car with two members of his staff. The governor strode up to the 2,000 reporters gathered at the appointed spot. He sadly entered the semicircle. Smooth's face was lit by the glow of the bright lights of six television cameras perfectly in the waning light. Then he smiled good-naturedly with the, "What are you going to do, shirk of the soldiers?" as the helicopter roared overhead. Smooth leaned his head down to listen to an assistant, then turned back to the cameras after the noise had subsided a bit. "Thank you for coming out," Smooth began. "Just so terribly important for the American people to understand what happened here today." In the coffee neighborhood, light rain turned to a shower. The sky darkened, the street lights came on, and the gutters began to fill. Josh Hall, Jane's little brother, looked out his parents' kitchen window and saw the porch lights in town blinking off and on. He reached way up for the switch next to the doorframe and joined in.
"And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security, COINTELPRO, Walmart, long underwear specialists are about average."
And that wraps up another New American Dream radio show. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll come back and visit next week, same time, same place. And tonight, be sure to stay tuned right here for Black Op Radio. Len has a very special show coming up right after this one. We thank the WorldNewsTrust.com and the SpiritualUN.org for sponsoring our show. And once again, we do thank all of you, our listeners. Thank you, and good night, Mike.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
WorldNewsTrust.com is a new site that is trying to define the new mainstream. Their founder, Francis Goodwin, is a veteran journalist who set out on his own a few years ago and has slowly carved out a niche. What does the site do? It tells the truth and provides a place for intelligent columnists to talk about what's really happening in America. It's a good site with people who care about what's going on in America and the world. It's a great site with many loyal writers, including Ramsey Baroud, Harvey Wasserman, Mickey Z. There are too many to list them all. Some content is published on World News Trust first, some is published elsewhere and copied to World News Trust. We also welcome back World News Trust, who continue to support our show and host our website. Visit World News Trust for a dose of news with enlightened and informed opinion. It's not like Fox or CNN or the New York Times. It's World News Trust, defining the new mainstream in online journalism. Visit them today and tell them the New American Dream Radio Show sent you. WorldNewsTrust.com.
What does it mean to be free? What has the war economy done to the lives of Americans? Join others for all the solutions at thespiritualun.org, because another world is possible. No human being is an enemy of another human being. War is a manufactured and artificial state. There is another way to live in this world through a new system that is uplifting to all. Let's go to a higher love. What did Jesus really teach? Did he teach onward Christian soldiers and bomb one another? No. John F. Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King Jr., Abraham Lincoln, our founding fathers, and you, your neighbors, all reaching for the best part of the human spirit. TheSpiritualUN.org. Come together with us. carrying forward this nation's founders' universal ideals through the rejection of revenge, aggression, racism, war, and the debt slavery system. Real men don't kill. War and the debt slavery system is a crime against us all, against God, against all life, and is not fit for a progressive world. Join together here at thespiritualun.org, and we will build that new world for the 99% of us, without any leaders, corrupt as they are, because in the new system that is uplifting to all, they aren't necessary anymore. thespiritualun.org.